I'd like to begin this evening by telling you a true story. Actually, I think there's an argument to be made that all stories are true, but this one I'm calling true because it happened to me. And it happened in India about 5 or 6 years ago. Just as an aside here, anyone who has read any history of art books may have read that perspective was discovered in the Italian Renaissance. But if you were to travel to Western India, visit cave monastery of Ajanta, you will find on the murals painted on the cave walls many examples of perspective predating the Renaissance by many hundreds of years. Anyway, a few years ago, I embarked on a tudong, on a walk around the, from Ajanta to Ellora. I did a big circle and went back to the nearest city. So I was walking through the countryside of Maharashtra and walking into local villages for alms in the morning and finding quiet places by the side of the road to rest at night. So one evening, after a long day's walk, I was walking through an area where there were hills adjoining the road, and I could see a rather big flat rock up on top of a hill. And I decided to climb up this hill and spend the night on top and meditate on the rock. So you have to be rather kind of furtive and cunning when you're looking for a place to rest on tudong in India, because if anybody sees you, then before long you'll be besieged with people begging you to spend the night in their house, because in India they'll always tell you, guest is God. And so it's their duty to make sure that you're looked after. So as a tudong monk, you don't want to be looked after. You want to meditate on big flat rocks in the moonlight. So you have to sort of make sure nobody's around and then sneak off the road and climb up the hill as quickly as you can. Well, I was generally successful at this, but on this one particular evening, as I was climbing up, I noticed a goat herd. He was watching me. He's about 17, 18-year-old boy. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to be disturbed. But as it happened, that didn't ensue, and I climbed up onto the hilltop, sat, meditated on this big rock. And it must have been around 8 o'clock in the evening, I guess, that I heard this sort of scrabbling sound on the hillside, because this hillside was covered with loose rocks, and somebody was obviously climbing up. And so I opened my eyes and looked, and the sort of head peeked over the top of the hillside, and it was the goat herd. And he walked towards me in the dark, and in his hand he had a big bunch of bananas. And so he stopped in front of me, bowed 3 times very beautifully, and offered me this big bunch of bananas. So this was a bit difficult for me because, as you know, monks don't eat bananas in the evening, or don't eat anything in the evening. And I couldn't speak his language, and he couldn't speak my language. So it did take some time to make him understand. And then he had a really good idea. He put the bananas down by the side and indicated that I could eat them tomorrow morning. So now I had to explain somehow that not only could I not eat the bananas this evening, but I couldn't store them overnight and eat them the following morning. Finally, he understood, and looking rather disappointed and crestfallen, he disappeared back into the darkness. And I considered that he'd probably been out on the hillside looking after his goats since early morning. And after a very long day, he'd walked all the way back to his village, which was about 2 or 3 kilometers away, and got these bananas, and then came out in the dark without a torch or a candle, climbed up this rather hairy slope in the darkness because he was afraid that I was hungry. So I was very moved by this, and I continued my meditation practice. And then very late at night, it must have been another couple of hours after that, I heard another scrambling sound up the hillside. Opened my eyes, and it was the same head appearing from the slope below. And it was the same young man carrying a blanket, a very old, threadbare blanket, with a big smile on his face. And I realized that he must have gone all the way home and got a blanket from his house, probably the only one he had. And he'd walked all the way back again, so late at night, in the darkness, stumbling around, climbed up this hill, offered me this blanket because he was afraid that I was cold. So I managed to explain to him that tomorrow morning I'll leave the blanket on the rock down at the foot of the hill there so you can pick it up. And he left looking very happy. And as I sat there, I thought to myself, what is it I'm feeling? And my answer was, I feel proud to be a human being. It's times like this that I'm proud to be a human being. And I, towards I came, when I came back, I'm speaking to school children, and I said, let's imagine a situation in which there's some far advanced civilization on another world, far advanced technology, and they've decided there's too many planets in this solar system, and one's got to go. And you've been selected as the lawyer. You're the one who's going to explain or to plead the case for humanity, why this particular planet deserves to remain in the universe. What is it that the human race has to offer to the universe that justifies eating up this space? And of course, it's a kind of elaborate way of encouraging people to say, what is it that really we can say, this is what makes me proud to be a human being? This is what we can say will stand up, you know, in the court, like out of the universe, and say, yes, you know, it's because human beings are like this that we deserve to continue. So if it was me, I would stand up in the court, imagine some kind of Star Trek scenario, and I would tell them the story about this young Indian man, because I think on the basis of this, human beings deserve to stick around for a while. So I am sure that I will never forget this young man, and I don't think he'll forget me either. And it's in acts of goodness, kindness, generosity that we see an incredible power and nobility that we can draw upon and utilize in our practice. Many of you may be familiar with the sutta passage in which someone asked the Buddha to express the heart, the essence of Buddha Dhamma. And Lord Buddha says, liberation, simply, liberation. is the essence of this teaching. And he gives the famous simile. He says, just as someone might take a sample of water from any of the oceans of the world, or any part of any of the oceans of the world, and wherever that sample of water was taken, it would share the same taste of salt. Similarly, every teaching of the Buddha, we can know it's an authentic teaching of the Lord Buddha if it has this taste of liberation. Now there, I think it's a very fruitful reflection. And we consider the various teachings of the Buddha and how we're often tend to categorize them, or to consider some teachings as being high or profound teachings, and others are kind of basic, fundamental or preliminary teachings. But what the Buddha is saying here is that all the teachings, if they are authentic, have this same taste of liberation. And it's not necessarily legitimate to consider some teachings as being superior to others. So my suggestion here is that dana, offerings of generosity, kindness, goodness, are liberating practices. In the traditional presentation of the Dhamma, we talk about dana, sila, bhavana. And many people are led on the basis of these distinctions to consider dana as being the foundation for the other practices. And that's a reasonable way of looking at dana. But at the same time, dana can be one part of the path to liberation. In the culmination of the path, we learn how to let go of identification with the five khandhas, with the body, with feelings, perceptions, thoughts, emotions, sense consciousness, as being me and mine. But through the acts of generosity which we perform, we are creating a familiarity, an ease, an appreciation, a love of giving up, of giving away, of letting go. So we begin with the material world, but the training, the education, expressing itself in giving and sharing material things is creating important karmic pathways, preparing the mind for the more and more subtle forms of letting go, to the extent that we can't separate them. Now, when we give in the way recommended by the Buddha, there's a small death every time. There's a small death of self. There's a shrinking of this empire that we hold on to so tightly, the empire of mine. This is mine. So through continual acts of giving, we change our perception of who we are. So just as the inner affects the outer affects the inner. And our sense of who we are changes through the way we act in the world. So it is a liberating practice with this regard. I'm reminded of my early years in Thailand, late 70s, early 80s, and going on alms round early in the morning into the local village. And all the villagers in local communities would know exactly at what time the monks would be walking past their houses. So first thing, they would make some sticky rice and then stand outside the house and wait for the monks to come. So it would be a time to say hello to neighbors. And often they bring out their children or even their grandchildren to teach them how to make offerings to monks. So, and this is, it's not so different today. But one difference is that in the early 80s, the people were very poor, and that most householders could only afford plain rice. So people would come with a plate, often with a plate with a lump of sticky rice, and they just sort of check how many monks were coming today, and then they divide the sticky rice into four lumps or five lumps. They put a lump in each monk's bowl. So if you carry, in those days we had these really big bowls as well, and if you had, say, 50 or 100 people, just a little lump of sticky rice, you got a pretty heavy bowl on the way back to the monastery. But we'd go past these houses, which were shacks, it was often ramshackle, little huts that seemed about to fall to pieces sometimes. And there would be somebody with a big smile on their face, ready to put a little ball of sticky rice in your bowl. And I really reflected on this many times and realized that every one of the villagers who was putting a small amount of sticky rice in their bowl considered themselves as a participant. They were a giver. They were someone who contributed to the sasana. They contributed to the well-being of the sangha. They had a part to play in the sangha's efforts, in their study and their practice and propagation of the Dhamma, because the monks were only able to perform all those worthwhile functions because they ate every day. So alms round was giving every person in the village, even the poorest person, could afford a lump of sticky rice. So every one of those had this sense of being a giver. And that's a very uplifting feeling, and one that gives rise to a great deal of self-respect, or as we would term it, self-esteem. So every time you give, even the smallest gift, you're making a tangible change in the world around you. You're proving to yourself through that gift that you can visibly reduce the amount of suffering in the world. You can visibly increase the amount of happiness in the world. Even if it's by the tiniest amount, it's still significant, and it's still a proof that you can contribute to this world that you find yourself in. So that's a liberation. It's a liberation from attachment to idea, this is me, this is my possession. It is a liberation from a sense of worthlessness, nothing to contribute. It is a realization of self-respect and a joy in being able to participate even in the in the slightest way, perhaps, in something that you uphold as being the most sublime or the most wonderful thing in your life, which is a Buddha sasana. So giving is a liberating practice. So it can't be measured by what you give or the monetary value of what you give, but in the purity of heart and the joy that can be derived from giving without desire for reward. So in the suttas, the Buddha states very clearly that giving without desire for reward reaps more merit than giving with desire for reward. But this is not a Buddhist philosophy. It's an observation that the Buddha is sharing with us. And it's one that we can all put to the test very easily, because we have all, haven't we, given both with the intention or the hope and desire for reward, and also we have given on certain occasions without any desire for reward at all. Now, if we recollect any act of giving in the past in which we expected a reward, when we recollect it, we feel indifferent. At least I do. It's the same kind of feeling that arises from memory of any other kind of mundane transaction. Because giving with the hope of reward is, in effect, a transaction. But when I recall acts of kindness and generosity which I performed in the past without any wish for any kind of recognition or reward, whether material or emotional or spiritual, then I feel exhilarated, I feel happy. My mind feels bright, joyous. And I'm suggesting, I believe that this is the same for everyone, that you would have this same experience. Now, in the 40 kamatanas, the 40 subjects for meditation, which we can find in the Visuddhimagga, there are some which are often neglected by Buddhist practitioners, and one of them is jhakānusati, which is anusati is recollection, and jhaka is acts of giving, kindness, generosity, and so on. So the Buddha is reminding us or pointing out that not only are acts of generosity liberating, not only do they uplift the mind at the moment of giving, but they are a treasure of the heart. And in systematically recollecting the goodness that we have performed in the past, we create a very powerful positive emotion which can deal very effectively with hindrances in meditation. Now, we've all reached that frustrating roadblock in meditation where we know all the techniques, we know all the skillful means, we know exactly what we should be doing, but it's just not working. And we get discouraged, maybe even give up altogether. But sometimes, when we're in that kind of state, or the mind is very intractable and resistant and stubborn, then recollecting acts of goodness that we performed can just, as if were, dissolve that kind of hard rigidity in our mind and replace it with a very warm, clear, bright consciousness. The sense of pamoja or brahmot arises, which can then develop into piti, into rapture, to sukha, to samadhi, and even to yathabhuta jnana dasana, the vision and understanding of things as they are. So all meditation techniques have to take us to that point of pamoja, that sense of intense well-being. And there are so many different ways in which we can reach that junction and reach that point. And the recollection of goodness is such an enjoyable way of overcoming hindrances that it's surprising how little people use it. It's a wonderful discovery. Those are a few words about dana and the liberating power of dana. I could talk about this for hours. It's a favorite subject, but I'll pass on to sila, because sila is a liberating practice. Sila, in the Buddhist sense, has to be voluntary. So if, for instance, you were to refrain from killing, harming, hurting others merely because you were afraid of going to prison, or you were afraid of criticism or the contempt of those you respect, then outwardly, although your conduct would be blameless, you would not be considered someone to possess sila. Because sila is the volition to refrain from certain acts, from certain kinds of speech that we undertake for the purpose of educating or elevating our conduct, for liberating the mind from a certain coarse desires and volitions. Yesterday in the Dhamma talk, I referred to the fact that forest monks and siladharas, of course, are said to be very strict. And I said, no, we don't feel we're strict. It's like a child who's obedient to its parents. We don't praise it for being strict in the same way. It's like the Buddha's our father, and we're just doing what he told us to do. So it's not a big deal. It's just normal. But the practice of sila is one that has to lead onwards to samadhi. So that's the test of it. And we take it on because we see, we have the wisdom to see the suffering which will inevitably arise from not taking care of the way that we relate to those around us. And we see the joy and the happiness and the inner peace that arises from taking care of our conduct. So, you know, being strict, being obedient, out of devotion to the Buddha, we keep these precepts. And some would say, well, you're attached to the rules. You know, so and I find this a kind of frustrating kind of criticism, because how do you disprove it? You know, so what am I supposed to do? Break some of the precepts to show that I'm not attached to them? It'd be like saying, you know, you're attached to driving on the left-hand side of the road, you know, so you should drive on the right-hand side of the road just to show how free of conventions you are. So I don't think that's a very wise attitude at all. But there's a difference between attachment and loyalty and commitment. Now, when you requested the precepts just now, the very fact that you request the precepts first before the monk gives the precepts is significant. It doesn't mean I browbeat you into taking the precepts. You take the precepts because you want to. You ask for them. And the phrases that we use are also significant. So in the first precept, panatipata veerapmani sikhapadang samadhiyami. So panatipata is to harm, to kill. Veerapmani, the intention to refrain. So quite straightforward. But the third word, sikhapadang. So sikha, it's the same word as sikha, the training or education. And samadhiyami is a very interesting word. Many of you may be familiar with the word upadana, which means clinging, attachment. And it's from the same root as the word samadana. And samadana means holding on to something with wisdom. So if you hold on to something with ignorance, it's called upadana. And if you hold on to something with wisdom and intelligence, it's samadana. So the word in the precept, samadhiyami. So it means I make the determination to wisely take hold of the precept as a means of educating my conduct. That's what it means when you take the precepts. So the idea of taking something wisely, you're going through a tunnel or somewhere dark and dangerous, and you take hold of a torch. It's one of Ajahn Chah's similes. Take hold of a torch, you put on the torch, you hold on to the torch until you emerge from the tunnel. You don't let go of the torch while you're walking through the darkness. Torch has a function to perform. You know what that function is. You know what a torch is, you know why you're using the torch, and you use it appropriately. This is samadana or samadhiyami. Now, the word mindfulness is now sort of entering the mainstream, but it's kind of been hijacked a little bit by various well-meaning groups. Interesting question. In the suttas, the Buddha gives a list of bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, upasikas, upasikas, who are foremost in various spheres of practice. Venerable Sariputta, foremost in wisdom. Venerable Mahamoggallana, foremost in psychic powers. Fair enough. But Venerable Ananda, foremost in sati, which we usually translate as mindfulness. This is puzzling, isn't it? If Venerable Ananda was a sotapanna, stream enterer. So how could he be foremost in sati when there are all these arahants? How could he have better mindfulness than the arahants? Well, the answer, of course, is that the way the word sati was used by the Buddha is not exactly the same way as it's used by John Kabat-Zinn and people like that. There's certain overlap, but the word mindfulness in this particular case could very well be translated as memory. Venerable Ananda is foremost in sati because he's the one who has this brilliant memory and can remember all the discourses word by word. So Sati is recollection, to bring the ability to bring to mind. But we can make a distinction between based upon the object of sati. So if the object of sati is in the past, then we might translate it as recall or recollection. But if the object of sati is in the present moment, for instance, the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose, then its function is to hold, not to forget. And this is, in fact, one of the most typical explanations of sati. It means not in meditation, it means not to forget what you're doing. In general, we could say not to forget what needs to be remembered. So in any situation you're in, remembering all you need to remember in order to function most effectively in that situation means you're mindful. But mindfulness is not this kind of amorphous floating quality of awareness or whatever. It's important to understand that mindfulness always needs an object. So the question that we need to be asking ourselves in any situation is, what should be the object of mindfulness? And we usually say, how can I be mindful? So slight rephrasing, what should be the object of mindfulness in this particular situation with these particular challenges? Now, my suggestion is that in daily life, particularly for householders or for lay Buddhists, the primary objects of mindfulness or sati are the precepts. So taking precepts on voluntarily as a means to educate our conduct means that we hold them in mind. We hold them in mind. We don't forget them. They're right there in the forefront of consciousness. And they provide a guarantee of safety. What I mean by that is that we're all going to get caught up, be deluded by defilements, by greed, hatred, and delusion. We're all going to talk ourselves into doing all kinds of foolish things with all kinds of very reasonable explanations for why it's a good thing to do. There's not a single defilement that cannot be presented in a very inspiring way. So because we do have this tendency and this habit to lie to ourselves and to, as in the Thai idiom, is take our own side, the five precepts provide this guarantee that even if we make mistakes, we get lost, we forget what needs to be remembered, those consequences won't be too drastic. So you're still on the path. You might not be jogging along the path, you might not even be walking briskly, but you will be at least crawling along, or you won't have fallen off on either side as long as you're keeping the five precepts. And the Buddha said that as long as people keep the five precepts, there will always be a human realm. So many people are worried about what's going to happen in December 2012, and the world's going to come to an end. Yet, we don't want it to, and I'm not indifferent to the end of the world, but at the same time, even if the world came to an end, it wouldn't be the end of the human realm, because there are people keeping the five precepts who will be reborn as human beings. Just as an aside, I was recently on the National Observatory on the highest mountain in Thailand, and the director was showing me around, and I said, how many planets do they estimate could support human life? And he said, in this galaxy, less than 1 in 1,000, which works out at about 80 million. And there are 100 million galaxies in the universe, so there's plenty more planets out there for human existence. But you have to keep the five precepts. I'm constantly finding new reasons, you know, for people to keep precepts. Stream entry is the point at which you can relax a little, because that's shutting the door to the lower realms. It's only at the level of stream entry that you can be absolutely certain that you'll never take rebirth in a lower realm again. Otherwise, you're in dangerous realm. You're still in the battlefield. As things change, conditions change drastically all the time, and you're not safe, basically. But the nearest thing that you can get to safety in the meantime, before reaching stream entry, which is the legitimate goal for practice for lay Buddhists, is the five precepts. Now, these five precepts are only the kind of the bare bones of sila. They're not the whole thing, but they're the most fundamental. Now, an example that I often like to give is, let's say you're being bitten by a mosquito. Oh, I'd like to tell you another thing. I've always been fascinated by hypnosis, and it always seems to me like a bit doubtful. And it seems to people seem to be hypnotized so easily. You know, if you see on TV or you see anything, you say, is it really that easy? So I asked somebody who knows about these things, and they said, well, actually, if you compare the brain waves of most people, meaning not us, but people who don't meditate regularly, and people in a hypnotic state, it's only about, is that different, you see? So all you have to do is just sort of take them over the edge, because most people are in a semi-hypnotic state already, okay? So the way that we live our life is with so much coming in, so much information, most people are on automatic pilot most of the time, or living their life rather like puppets or marionettes. You know, somebody says something nice and you're happy, and somebody says something bad and you go down. So sort of like puppet existence, automatic pilot existence. So in that kind of mental state, a mosquito bites and the automatic response is to slap the mosquito. But, you see, you've taken a precept. It's in the forefront of your mind. You're very sincere about this. The mosquito bites and you're just about to squat the mosquito, and what am I doing? You stop. Now, this is such a wonderful and interesting moment to examine, because what's happened is you've woken up. You've woken up from this semi-hypnotic sleep state of trying to maximize the pleasant and minimize the unpleasant wherever you can as your sort of basic mode of living. You wake up. You stop and you say, what am I doing? Is this right? Is this wrong? Is this appropriate? Inappropriate? Is this in line with my goals and my aspirations in life? Or is it in conflict with them? So all these moral, ethical questions, considerations appear because we've stopped. We've stopped and given ourselves the opportunity to examine, what am I doing right now? And we stopped because we recollected the precept. we were mindful of the precept and we were able to decide, well, no, I really don't want to kill that mosquito. Just blow it away. Or if you're really keen, you just watch it bite you and you say, yes, enjoy, or something like that. But that's probably a bit hardcore, but you can just blow it away. But, you know, other than that, what happens is, you know, you have this sort of general kind of, I've metta for all loving beings, but you're not fulfilling the sila side of the practice. So, you know, the mosquito bites you, and say, oh, may you have a happy rebirth. So it's like metta without wisdom. So, sila, keeping precepts, is a mindfulness practice. It's not a preparation for mindfulness. It's a liberating practice. It provides a sense of self-respect. When you consciously establish boundaries for your conduct without external pressure, because you want to educate, elevate your conduct, and then you are able to express yourself within those boundaries, even when there are temptations and pressures to break precepts, then we feel a great deal of sense of self-respect. And the meditation topic that follows on from Jaganasati, or maybe precedes it, I can't remember, is Silanasati. So it's not just that it's a practice in itself, but recollecting your keeping of the precepts purely gives rise to this same kind of positive emotion which can overwhelm and replace hindrances in meditation. The recollection of your sila is a means of leading the mind out of negative emotions, hindrances, and taking it to pamoja and then on to piti, sukha, samadhi, and so on. So it is a meditation in itself. Now as monastics, we can use this very well because we give so much attention to sila. I've been living in Thailand for 34 years now, and in forests sometimes with malarial mosquitoes and scorpions and centipedes and all kinds of creepy crawlies and wild animals. And you know, I'm not especially special kind of bhikkhu here, but 34 years I've never consciously killed a single creature, not deliberately. And if I recollect that, just remembering that, it just makes me feel so wonderful. So, you know, when we look at sila, you don't do this and you don't do that, and it's like you're restricting yourself and you're repressing, but there's a wonderful creativity in sila, and the recollection of sila and the nobility and beauty of conduct and the fact that your external expression in the world is in harmony with your spiritual ideals, rather than you're strengthening with your conduct and your speech the very mental states that you're seeking to transcend in meditation, which is often the case with many meditators, because they don't see the relationship between the outer and the inner clearly. So if you really want to know, Buddha said, what's a wise person? How do you know a sage? How could you tell? And Buddha didn't say because he looks really kind of radiant, or she looks really kind of radiant and peaceful and all these kinds of things. But the Buddha said that someone who doesn't harm himself or others is a sage. So it's not a kind of knowing a lot, or it's not, he's not stressing wisdom, he's stressing conduct. If you want to know who's really intelligent, you know, you don't look at their academic qualifications. The famous saying of Ajahn Chah, you know, people got bachelor's degrees and they get very puffed up about it, but they forget that their defilements have got bachelor's degree as well. They've got a master's degree and their defilements have got master's. They're a doctor and their defilements are doctors as well. Got PhDs as well. But you can tell, a very simple way to tell how smart someone is whether or not they keep the five precepts. Because failure to keep the five precepts is a failure of intelligence. Because if, I think we'll all agree that we are all interested in promoting our own long-term welfare. But breaking the precepts is detrimental to our long-term welfare and prevents us from progressing in the Dhamma. So breaking a precept is acting against our own most cherished goals and objectives in life. And so I conclude that someone who breaks the precepts is lacking intelligence, even if they've got a PhD. And you can say that person's not smart because they're not acting in ways consistent with their best interests. So in Thai I say, so if you don't keep the precepts, you're banya on. You see, it's a sign of banya on. So the precepts, and you don't have to, it's not just a matter of precepts, you can create your own practices. You notice a particular weakness and difficulty that you have, create a practice for yourself. We live in a very complex world right now, information overload. And there's a great need for a filtering of information and for time management skills. I think that most of us will shrink away from that which is quite obviously harmful and evil, but the great trap into which almost everyone is falling these days is the trap of the trivial. We lead such trivial lives. Social media is just expanding on the amount of trivia in people's lives. There's hardly any distinction between news and entertainment these days, is there? News is often trivia. Call it news, but basically it's pointless trivia. So the response to this or reaction to this is also, well, you know, it doesn't hurt anybody, it's harmless, it feels good, why not? But this is a wrong way of looking at it, because we only have our lives are only so long, we don't have very much time at all, and if we spend a lot of time on what is ultimately trivial, it means we don't have time left for what is profound. So it's not that these things are bad in themselves. We're not taking this sort of Puritan or punitive kind of attitude, you should stop, it's bad. No, but we have to find what's podi. What's the right amount? Not too much, not too little, not too tight, not too loose. What's the right amount? And then how do we decide what's the right amount? Well, you can only decide on what's the right amount when you have an ultimate goal or destination. My favorite example, tomorrow I'm going to Newcastle. So I'm going to Newcastle tomorrow If I go through Leeds, is that right? Is that the right way to go to Newcastle? And I hope everybody would say, yes, that's the right way to go to Newcastle. So if I was to say, change my mind, I just want to go for a drive, see England, just want to see the countryside, would it be correct to go to Leeds? You can't answer the question, but it's now meaningless. You say, yes, you can go to Leeds if you want, you can go to London, because you're just going for a drive. You know, you can go whatever direction you want. There's no right or wrong, correct or incorrect, because you don't have a destination. The question is meaningful if you have a destination. Leeds is the correct route because you're going to Newcastle, you're going to the north. So the reason why so many people are heedless and complacent about the precepts, particularly the fifth precept, also to a certain extent the fourth precept, is because they're not bearing their goal in mind. If you consider that the path to liberation is a very difficult path, a lot of obstacles, you conclude that the most rational thing to do is to minimize all those things that make it hard to be mindful, make it hard to be clear and wakeful in life, and to maximize all those things that support clarity of mind and mindfulness. So you have this goal of inner freedom, inner liberation, freedom from suffering and its causes, perfection of wisdom and compassion, and you say, this is something that takes me away from my destination. It doesn't lead me further on to my destination. Therefore, I will leave it. I will reject it. But if you're just sort of driving around and just sort of spending your time, yeah, why not? It doesn't hurt anybody else. It's not against the law. It's okay. It's not harmful, really. Yes, as long as you don't have a destination in mind, that's a very good argument. But if you have a destination in mind, it's a very unwise argument. So we're in all our dealings with the material world, with internet, with Facebook, with all these things. What's the right amount? How much time should we devote to them? In practice, one of the obstacles that I think most people would recognize is this inner commentary in the mind, going on and on, commenting, judging, observing, talking in the mind, and creates a kind of a membrane between ourselves and our experience. And although I've never really been involved with this very much, it seemed to me that some of these social media, like Facebook, increase that tendency to be commenting on experience all the time, you know, always preparing to express it to somebody else, even the extent of, you know, today I'm going to clean the fridge or something like this. You have to type that out. I mean, how bizarre is that? You know, sometimes I have a look at Facebook pages of family members, and I just to see what people do on them, and just think. You know, if you're a dewa, you know, and you're living for about millions of years, you know, you've got enough time to type onto your computer, I'm about to clean out the fridge. But we're not devas, you know, we have a very short lifespan. And, you know, I value your time more. So, you know, everyone's, you know, coming from different place and things, but what I really suggest is have this sense of what's the right amount, what's podi, and say that question you can only answer when you have a sense of, you know, where you're really going in your life and what are the qualities which you're seeking to develop. And observing and understanding all those factors that support the path and all those factors that pull us off of the path, and try to act accordingly. So Pavana is cultivation, and the traditional presentation of dana, sila, pavana. I'm suggesting that dana is a kind of pavana, sila is a kind of pavana, because they all involve the abandonment of the unwholesome, the development of the wholesome, purification of the mind, the liberating practices. All 84,000 dhammas that the Buddha taught are liberating practices. And so liberation is the essence, the heart of the teaching, and it's a way that we orient ourselves with all our different activities, all our different practices, inner and outer. Constantly bring to mind, is this a liberating practice? Is this liberating us from attachment to the idea of me and mine? So thank you for your patience. I've spoken, I think, beyond the usual time limit. So as I only come every 2 years, I think you'll forgive me, and thank you for your patience. And
Sadhu karam dharma se.